Hello, I'm Matt Carpenter, and this is the Good Life Podcast.
Hello, we are back with the Good Life Podcast, and today I have the honor of interviewing Dr. Christopher Duncan. Dr. Duncan teaches at St. Louis University, and he has his graduate, his doctorate degree from Wayne State University, and he's written several books that are very unique, not areas that a lot of people hear about. The book that first grabbed me is one that he published in 1995, so a little over a quarter of a century ago at this point, The Anti-Federalist and Early American Political Thought. And then a few years later, he published one called Fugitive Theory, Political Theory, The Southern Agrarians and America. The Southern Agrarians are a group that I've always appreciated. And then his most recent book, just published this year, is called Radical Conversion, Theorizing Catholic Citizenship in the American Liberal State. So, Dr. Duncan, thank you for being with us today.
Matt, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here with you.
So we'll just get right started with, you know, really, in your first book on the anti-federalist, a lot of people, when they hear that term, it doesn't bring much of anything to mind, because the anti-federalists are neglected, a neglected group from colonial American history. But before we get to that, in that book, you don't just go straight to the history. You start by talking about different terms. And those terms, one we hear a lot and one we don't hear as much, those terms are liberalism and republicanism. So you teach political theory and you teach American history. So what is the difference between those two words?
So at least in the work that I do, right, liberalism is a body of thought that emerges in basically the 15th, 16th century, right? So associated with people like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. And republicanism is a much older tradition, going all the way back, at least for me, to Aristotle, but certainly then through people like Cicero and Polybius and some of the Roman republican thinkers. And liberalism is primarily understood as an ideology of individualism, right? So the whole notion of the individual with their rights and their liberties, and in particular rights to life, liberty, and property, becomes a very important sort of strand of thought in resisting the ancien regime or divine right monarchy. But prior to liberalism, republicanism is really about what we'd think of as civic virtue incarnate, the idea of citizenship, citizens with duties and responsibilities more so than rights, and people whose primary task was to seek out the common good for their citizenry and to live noble and virtuous lives of service, if that makes some sense.
Oh, yes, it does. So the Republican tradition then is one that we could, I mean, could we say, I've heard some say, that it goes back, something you can trace to the Hebrews in the Old Testament, even though they had a monarchy. There's also the arguments made by some that there is a republican tradition in the ancient Hebrew governments, and then certainly with the Greeks and Romans at their high points, they were republican in nature. Is that a safe statement to make?
From my perspective, yes. Now, I'm certainly not an Old Testament scholar. I'm very familiar with the Old Testament, but I don't want to sort of get too far out over my skis, as they say. But sure. My reading of sort of ancient Jewish civilization and Hebrews, clearly the idea was present in the Psalms. Clearly the idea was present in the books of the Old Testament, that there was a virtuous form of regime, that there were rules and laws, obviously, that people needed to order their lives around, and certainly the sense that the collective or the community was of more importance than the individual person. And so really thinking about them through the lens of a covenanted community, right? A community that's come together in which there are not only the members of the community itself, but where God is a partner in that enterprise, clearly to me at least gives them the antecedent conditions for what we would think of later as republicanism.
Right, okay. And then, you know, certainly you have, and you make this point well in your most recent book, Radical Conversion. You have an entire chapter given to Socrates and the Eutropho, and the arguments that he makes there. So I've said before that there's a lot of Socrates is calling the Greeks to reform in the way that the Old Testament prophets called Israel to reform. They're calling them to that life of virtue that they had largely abandoned at the time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, right? So Socrates, as presented there, is absolutely a prophetic voice. Again, he wouldn't have understood himself as a prophetic voice in the same way that you and I might use that language. But for Socrates, and I do a little of this in the book through some of the notes, it's not real well developed, but what I always have argued with my students is that Socrates is looking back at a Greek tradition that really predated in some ways the emergence of Imperial Athens, which is where he finds himself right at that point late in his life when he's eventually put to death. And by and large, looking back at the Battle of Salamis as a sort of critical turning point for the Greeks when they defeat Xerxes and the Persians, the first thing that happens is that they really give praise to the gods and are thankful and grateful for the gifts that they've been given. But over time, what begins to happen is that degenerates into a kind of pridefulness and a self-praise where they start to think of themselves as the authors of their own success. And that lack of deference for Socrates becomes, I think, a critical turning point in the way the Athenian society begins to see itself. And when it then embarks upon its own imperial aspirations during the Peloponnesian Wars, and then still later throughout the Aegean Sea, and Socrates is saying, wait, you forget where you came from. You forget what made us strong in the first place, which was this kind of faithful adherence to a traditional set of values and rules that now we've forsaken in the name of our own power and our own strength, and what later on we would call hubris.
Right. And then you can see a similar type of trajectory in Rome as well, when they begin, you know, they start out with a form of classical republicanism that begins to decline. You know, Virgil celebrates some of those attributes, but then as they transform from that into a stronger monarchy, then you have a lot of the same laments from Roman philosophers also, don't you?
Absolutely. And so you see critiques of luxury in particular, right? The sort of neglect of the duties and responsibilities of citizenship, the attempt to accumulate greater and greater amounts of wealth, and then certainly some of the decadence that begins to follow in the pursuit of pleasure as opposed to the pursuit of virtue and honor. And all of those contribute then ultimately to, at least in those theorists' minds, right, Rome's degeneration and decline and eventual fall. Probably one of the better sort of American depictions of this, if anybody's interested, is in a series of paintings that Thomas Cole, who was part of the Hudson River School, in the 1900s did was called The Course of Empire, in which he sort of maps out sort of five stages of development from what he calls the sort of pastoral state to this state that looks like ancient Rome to decay and civil war and decline and then eventually desolation.
Well, the rest of that story is one that could map out very well with the United States. I mean, everything you just said, from ancient foundings, although we're not ancient as an empire, but you know, our early foundings throughout, and which is what I hope the rest of the conversation can emphasize. So at one point in your first book on the Anti-Federalist, you said, quote, "Many liberals must realize that much of what is best in the liberal state is a byproduct of its Republican antecedents," end quote. So I take that to mean what we like about our society now. And by we, I'm talking about conservative, communitarian-minded, Christian, natural law thinking people. The culturally Christian, essentially, at the very least, who are conservative. What we like about society are actually from our Republican roots, not from some type of contract theory that's superimposed on us. How would you describe that? Or would you just say, I already said it in my book, so I don't want to describe it further.
So I'd borrow here, right? So in And After Virtue, the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who I'm a big fan of, talks about Western society in general as basically living off of a kind of moral savings account that was created by our ancestors. And his argument, I can't do it justice in this short of format, but his argument is basically that when we look at some of the things that I think for me take seriously in the liberal tradition, broadly understood, the sacredness of the individual, for example, right? The idea of the inviolability of the human person and the notion, right, that the human person exists in a web of thick relationships with other human beings, who then are charged with working with one another to both preserve their way of life as well as to preserve their individual lives and livelihoods. For him, that moral savings account is slowly but surely being depleted until we come to a point when people don't even remember that there was a time before this world that we look at now, which is filled, at least in the language that I use, with a lot of very possessive individualistic characteristics. So the roots, I think we're agreeing, maybe not with everything that you said in terms of who I am, right? Whether I fit into all the categories that you listed, but I certainly fit into some of them pretty well. But that having been said, absolutely, this idea that there's been a moral savings account that we aren't replenishing at this point, but we are drawing down to a point at which there may not be any resources left for future generations, I think is a scary thought.
Yes. And, you know, and just, you know, so that everyone knows, I mean, that they know I'm a Reformed Protestant pastor and you are Roman Catholic. When was your official, when was your conversion? It was not from birth. I mean, so.
No. I joined the Catholic Church in Starkville, Mississippi, and I was 34 years old, so I'm 58 years old now. So somebody else can do the math, but somewhere in the 1990s, I'd have to go back and pinpoint the exact date, but probably about 1995, 96, right in there.
I like a humanities man who leaves math to others. That's exactly what I do.
Although everybody moves to Starkville, Mississippi, right, to join the Catholic Church. So
that's exactly right. Yes, I've heard of none. You're the very first I've heard. But you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. So we take what He sends us. In general, we are, you know, so I can tell you, I was discussing your book with one of my Anglican friends, and I was telling him about your work, and he said, I don't know where we'd be without some of those Catholic brothers, he said, because they know what it's like to be treated poorly in the American system, so they can teach us some things right now about what it's like to be second-class citizens, because that's been their lot for a lot of times in American history. So anyway, so again, hedging on your, you know, your most recent book, there's a lot of information, a lot of things that we can learn about that. But before we get there, to step back, you know, some of the earliest settlers in colonial North America were the Puritans. And there is a common perspective on the Puritans that says they were middle-class merchants who were very wealthy. You know, going back to the English Civil War, they won the English Civil War. They beheaded King Charles. So, you know, and I know even some of the Marxists project them. Let's see, what the last name, Hill. I cannot think of it. Is it Eric Hill or something like that? Marxist writer who...
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm drawing the name right off the top of my head, but...
But in his book, The World Turned Upside Down, he writes about the Puritans in a very positive way, actually, which, you know, as a Marxist, you have to, you know, when you're reading a Marxist and they talk glowingly about someone, you immediately have some, you know, some concerns there. So many project the Puritans as in a negative light in that sense, bringing a strong form of modernity to bear. But your book doesn't, I mean, it presents an honest assessment, I think, you know, the anti-federalist, but it has a much more positive view of their contribution. So what was the good contribution that the Puritans brought when they established the colonies in North America?
Yeah. So to the extent that the Puritans' praxis, right, their merging of theory and practice was done well, you go back to John Winthrop's famous speech on the flagship Arabella in 1630, right, where he talks about the famous sort of city on a hill. But embedded in that speech, that's the only line that most people ever remember, but he has a long passage where he talks about Micah, and he talks about our duty and responsibility to make each other's burdens our own, to walk humbly with one another and with our God, and to, by and large, knit together is the language that he uses into one body. And to the extent that those communitarian sentiments and those ideals about our duties and responsibilities to fellow citizens was lived out in some ways, that's what I find incredibly positive and endearing in terms of the Puritans. Couple that then with their notion of their right to govern themselves as they understood their call from God and their desire to live in a perfectible community, right? And again, all of these things have dark sides to them potentially, right? We end up with things like witch trials and certain kinds of exclusions from the community of people that you know, were, I think, important and interesting thinkers, people certainly like Anne Hutchinson on one hand, who gets excluded, and then Roger Williams, of course, on the other side of the equation, who gets excluded. And those are some of the darker sides. But the positive sides for me is this sense of a strong communal ethic of mutual duties and responsibilities and the call to love one another as they've been loved.
Yes. And I know that in David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, he talks to great extent about the Puritan ethic and way of life, which gave me a rebirth in my appreciation for what they were trying to do, because they were, in one sense, they were breaking away from the clan culture that had dominated Europe and the Mediterranean, going back to the Greeks and Romans. They were getting out of that, you know, purposely trying to go back to the best they saw of the Hebrew covenanted community
Absolutely.
Idea.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
One of the stories that I'm fond of telling, and I steal this from the American playwright Arthur Miller. So I wrote a play called The Crucible, which of course was ostensibly about the witch trials, but really, of course, about McCarthyism. But there's this scene in that play where he has a character named Giles, and Giles is being asked to sort of inform on his brothers and sisters in the community, and he's being pressed between two large stones. And when they say, you know, please confess and tell us, right, who else is guilty, and his response is, more weight, please. And I always think to myself of that image when I talk to my students about the Puritans, and I say, on one hand, that strong form of community was pressing a man between two large rocks. On the other side of the equation, though, that strong community formed a man who was capable of resisting that and siding with his friends till the bitter end. And so you get both, right, in that one little snippet or scene of the dark side and the bright side of what was a strong covenant community.
That's an amazing picture. And I've never really cared for the way that Miller projects Puritanism.
Oh no, it's that scene that I'm
right. Well, I was about to say, but that scene is a redeeming quality, certainly, in that I'd not thought about before the way you tell it here. So we had the Puritans, and of course we could talk about the other groups who were here, but I'm really interested in the conversation in tracking this alternative American tradition that's not what we think of. You know, today the only thing we think about mostly when it comes to politics are Republicans and Democrats, red, blue, you know, what side are you on? Or, you know, by its more to the point question, do you wear masks or not? I mean, that's how we determine everything, sadly. But this alternative tradition is more communitarian and does not go for the nationalistic perspective, you know, that's projected now. So going from the Puritans to the Anti-Federalists, now that is a jump. So maybe you could tell us, and you could take this in whichever you want to take first is fine. So I'm interested, though, to hear from you, who were the Anti-Federalists, and then what is the link from the Puritans to that group? So you can, whatever order you want to answer those in.
Yeah. So I'm not a good enough historian, right? I'm a political theorist to make really good connections. So it's much more analogical for me in a lot of instances. But to start with your first question, right? The Anti-Federalists were a diverse group, right? So there was a whole range of Anti-Federalist views ranging from those in New England to those in the Mid-Atlantic states to those in the South. And they had a diversity of views, which is in some ways, right, what they have in common is a kind of very, very, I think, healthy respect for diversity and pluralism and an understanding that the right that human beings have to organize and govern themselves according to their values and their morals and their deeply held beliefs was something that was worthy of deep and abiding respect and protection, even when there were significant and serious disagreements, right, about what the form of government ought to look like, what those values and morals and religious ideals were, varying from Anglicans, right, to Calvinists, to all those in between, and even a smattering of Catholics here and there. But that all having been said, the Anti-Federalists, of course, you know, and your readers may not, or your listeners may not, is really a misnomer, right? It was a label given to a group of thinkers by their adversaries, the Federalists, as a way of trying to put them into a political box that made them look as though they were opposed to a federal system, when in reality, of course, they were strong proponents of a deeply federal system that involved strong arguments for the rights of states and local communities to govern themselves and to be protected from distant, powerful governments that may not have respect or knowledge of local conditions and local beliefs and ideals. And so the Anti-Federalist, if we were talking about what sort of ties them together, it was a deeply held suspicion of centralized power and authority and a strong penchant for self-government and strong communities in my reading of them.
So to go back, you know, for those who may not recall the political arguments going on in post-revolutionary America. So you have, after the war between the United States and Britain, the states gained their independence, but we didn't go directly from independence to a constitution, to our current constitution. We had the Articles of Confederation.
Right. So the Articles of Confederation, 1781, right? Constitution ratified 1789.
Right. So you had these years, and of course, in textbooks, and I say this with confidence because I taught history for 15 years, so I would see it every year. It always gives a list. It tells you that the Articles of Confederation was our first constitution, and here are between 6 and 10 reasons why it was terrible. And that's what the textbooks say, and that's what teachers, back when we had a state graduation exam, I, as a teacher, was expected to teach my students, and it would be on the graduation exam, that the students had to know why the Articles of Confederation was terrible.
And that's exactly the case. And it's still the case in a lot of books. Even contemporary college textbooks, right, similar kinds of, you can always imagine, right, there'll be, here's the section on the Anti-Federalist, and here's why the Articles of Confederation that they seem to support failed. Right? It's always an assumption of failure. Now, some of this, to use the old cliche, is that history gets written by the winners. And to some extent, those who carried the day ultimately drowned out those alternative voices in a number of different ways. But one of the first sort of important articles on the Anti-Federalists written by a historian named Cecile Kenyon back in the 1950s was titled Men of Little Faith. And my first article on the Anti-Federalist, which was published prior to the book, was titled Men of a Different Faith. And the argument that I make is not that there was a continuum of success and failure, but that there were two separate projects that were simultaneously going on. Each of them was entitled on some level to define progress and success for itself. And the way that the Anti-Federalist would have defined success would have been through the maintenance of strong community and strong communal liberty to govern themselves, whereas the Federalist would have defined it more in terms of things like efficiency and economic growth and a certain amount of prominence, right, in the world. If that's not what you're seeking, it's hard to accuse you of failing to achieve it.
Right, yes.
Of course, once the terms of debate get set where efficiency and progress and wealth are defined as the end-all and be-all, right, of the success story, then everything that doesn't contribute to that suddenly becomes retrograde or somehow deficient.
Right, yes. And so that argument, I remember when I read that in your book, I thought, this nails it. Because, yes, most project the, and again, for listener's sake, let me stop. So once we come to 1788 or 87, Alexander Hamilton, among others, says the Articles of Confederation are not working. We need a new government. He didn't say that, actually. He said, we need to revise the articles. And so they called a gathering in Philadelphia. And so they said, we're going to revise them. They got everybody there. And he said, oh, but actually, we're not going to revise them. We're going to scrap them. Liar. I'm letting my early political opinion show here, but yes, that's
what the language. I think it was Patrick Henry, right, who said, I think I smell a rat. And
yes,
right, most of the Anti-Federalists at that point, right, walked out and basically went home. So you ended up seeding, in some ways, probably from a political perspective, wrongly, but tactically, they felt as though they had been unduly compromised by coming to something, at least that I would characterize as in good faith, to try and figure out if there weren't things that you could do to strengthen the Articles of Confederation while preserving the core principles of those articles. And yet when they got there, discovered, of course, that it, like you just said, had been more or less discarded, and that they were beginning from theoretically a blank slate, even though, of course, there were people who already had very strong ideas about where they wanted to see things go. And so they went home, sat out the Constitutional Convention, and then made most of their really strong arguments in the context of state ratifying conventions.
Right. And so the people who supported the new Constitution, Hamilton, Madison, and others, are the Federalists, and those who, the co-belligerents, we could say, who did not support it, are the Anti-Federalists. And you know, this, though, goes back to what you were talking about. The Anti-Federalists are your classical Republicans, who they're communitarians, they want civic virtue, and that's such a wonderful vision. For society, it's sad.
And yet there were certainly modern thinkers among the Anti-Federalists. So Thomas Jefferson is kind of an interesting figure. I always place him mostly in the Anti-Federalist camp, to that extent. But Jefferson also has very modern ideas and tendencies when it comes to philosophy and religion that I don't necessarily embrace. Person sure. who takes it upon himself to edit the Bible gives me pause, shall we say.
Thank you. Yes, me too. Me too. So, but yeah, and he is an interesting character because, you know, while on one hand he had anti-federalist views, he was in France at the time, I believe, as an
Absolutely.
Ambassador. So he was away, but on one hand he has those views, his notes, the notes on Virginia, I believe, that he wrote, that they are very conservative, you know, the old type conservative, the good type of conservative. But then his, once he becomes president, and I think Herbert Agar in his book on early America, on American history, I cannot remember which one it is, but he talks about Jefferson being so idealistic that he was not able to do a lot of good when he was in office as the president. He even though he comes across as an anti-federalist, he did not lead as an anti-federalist as a president.
Well, and it's hard to accept the job of president, which is created by the Federalist and has
right.
a particular
kind right.
of, and not eventually give way to the trappings and powers and ideas that went into creating the office. And so it's always the catch 22 about being on the inside versus being on the outside. And certainly there's co-option that happens once you're in those roles. It's hard to avoid.
Yes. So we get a new constitution, and you know, the debate somewhat died down for a time, although never fully went away. But what we did get a new set of values, essentially, for what the government should do and what it should be with that new constitution. And you talked about efficiency and growth, and you know, certainly Hamilton, strong industrialist, wanted the government to work with industry to create something that would be great and that would make us an economic powerhouse.
Yes.
So, you know, even to the point of overriding those old virtues, which again, you know, tracing back to those different stages or the course of empire, you know, you could see, even though I've not seen the Thomas Cole series, I could guess that you could chart these things. And while the North eventually became much more industrialized, the South retained a degree of, whether you call it backwardness or, you know, they the South was not a panacea. Certainly, if you were black, it was not at all. But they were trying to maintain something that they that many understood had been lost. And so someone like Eugene Genovese does a, you know, he talks about this in his book, The Southern Tradition. So tell us some about the change that took place. I think it's in the Fugitive Theory book. You talk about how America went from embracing its old Republican ideas to embracing the gospel of wealth and individualism. So how did that happen? And again, I'm not asking for a timeline necessarily, but you know, just give us an overview of how did we go from one to the other? Because it wasn't overnight. The average American, let's say in Georgia in 1792, didn't say, "Well, I got to go read John Locke now because this is the new way." So, how did things change over the next 50 or so years?
Yeah, you know, so this is a really truncated version of the story, but certainly you mentioned Hamilton, right? And Hamilton was a figure who thought in terms of what he called a commercial republic. And for some of us, and I would put myself in this camp, the idea of a commercial republic is something of an oxymoron. Certainly the way that Hamilton used the phrase, because it assumed that somehow you could maintain the virtues associated with small self-governing communities based in geographically grounded areas and combine it with a more cosmopolitan, industrial, global for its time, right? Capitalism without somehow losing anything in the process. And of course, there are lots of Republican thinkers who would have said that most of the preconditions for maintaining a virtuous republic involved avoiding embracing excesses of wealth and luxury and the kind of economic engine that capitalism provided. And so, again, Hamilton at least seemed to think that you could put those two together and somehow maintain the former by adding the latter on top of it. I don't know that that was possible. And to that extent, though, Hamilton obviously wins the argument, right? There's this, I can't remember which historian said it. It may have even been Genovese, but that if you go to Washington, D.C., there are monuments to all sorts of people like Jefferson and Lincoln, but there's not a statue to Hamilton. And the argument that the author makes is that's because the entire city is actually a statue to Alexander Hamilton. That on some level, Hamilton's victory, and again, giving him more credit than an individual ought to get, but Hamilton's larger victory was ultimately that he set the terms for debate for the future in ways in which there was a logic to it that trying to escape from it placed you, as you just said a minute ago, in either a retrograde position vis-a-vis progress and the new world, left you behind or left you out, right? So you either had to join the conversation or be treated as something foreign and ancient and I'm losing my words here, but something retrograde. And by the time we get then to, you know, the Civil War and the post-Civil War, and when we think about the impact that Lincoln has, right? Lincoln has, you know, the title of Foreigner's book, right, is free soil, free labor, free men. And right. On some level, this kind of petite bourgeois capitalism that's found in Abraham Lincoln, of the idea here again of an early capitalism, an early industrialism, and an idea of progress as material growth, really becomes something that captures at least the popular imagination in the United States. You add on to that this notion of democratic capitalism, and the idea that anybody now can become wealthy, that anybody can become an entrepreneur, that anybody can grow up to be rich. And this becomes really a kind of a cultural motif with massive power. And it's still with us today. Again, I'm babbling a little bit. I'm sorry for the
lack of focus.
But, you know, Horatio Alger, who becomes this novelist, right, in the 1880s, 1890s, he publishes 127 books, and all of them have exactly the same plot.
Characters
like Matchbook Mark and Ragged Dick and Tattered Tom, all these young men, right, who eventually come from very lowly, humble origins, and through hard work and perseverance become respectable members of society, where respectable members of society is based on having a position and a job and producing income and wealth and acquiring material goods. And Algerism, as an ideological form of Americanism, becomes the story that we tell about what goodness is, about what virtue is, about what success looks like. And that is a powerful and important part of the American psyche. And to the extent that you didn't get on board with that, you were ultimately not seen as a person to be taken seriously.
Yes. So, I mean, this is not, I started to say earlier that there was a type of catechesis going on, but this is more than catechesis. This is myth. And myth is much more. I mean, so I can tell my kids that, like in our church, we have the Westminster Shorter Catechism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can teach my children the questions and answers to the Shorter Catechism, and they can memorize them. Like the very first, what is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. You know, that's a good statement in the abstract, and that's fine, but. But they will remember stories, though, from the Bible long after they've forgotten the questions and answers.
100%. And if I can take a small flight of fancy here. So I have a 2-year-old grandson who I watch quite frequently. And one of the television shows that he watches is this very sort of strange cartoon called Stinky and Dirty, which is the story about a friendship between a trash truck and a forklift or a digger. And in any case, in one of the cartoons, one of the storylines, which is fascinating, is they're trying to remember materials that they need to go and acquire to build something, but they keep getting to the place where the materials are and they can't remember what they went there for. And so they invent this entire story in which each of the materials becomes a character in the story, and their story then becomes a quest where they have to, right, defeat these various forces along the way and accumulate the items that they couldn't remember for themselves. But now that they've been placed in the story, right, I realize it's silly, but and then they end up at the end of this being able to tell the whole story, and they remember everything. And again, in its own little microcosmic, strange little way, this cartoon does exactly what you just said, right? You embed these things in a story. You give people characters. You give people a plot. You give people heroes and villains. You give people glory, let's say, at the end, or honor at the end. And all of a sudden, this becomes something that you can take with you forever.
Yes, because it, you know, to talk about flights of fancy, but this becomes an imitation of the gospel retold.
Of course.
In a sense. You know, all great stories have something related to the gospel, because all good stories end either from the perspective of the right when you have glory, or if it's, you know, the bad side, you have tragedy. So, you know, that's how they end. And what I was saying earlier, I mentioned Hamilton in a negative sense. And, you know, I'm not saying that he himself was an absolute wicked person.
Oh, no.
I know he converted to Christianity later in his life. You know, there are good things about him. Abraham Lincoln, who's a student of Hamilton, and governed in much the same way as a rural Hamiltonian would. He had a lot of the same vision, and it's not a sinful vision per se, but going back to your discussion of the Federalist and Anti-Federalist, but it is for Hamilton and Lincoln, it is an alternative vision. It's a different vision from the older communitarian perspective of the Puritans at their best, the Anti-Federalists, and other groups who would come along. And, you know, the South before the war between the states, not all of them, but many of them did not, I mean, they knew that this could not continue. These two separate tracks,
sure,
of a more feudal society in the South and a much more modern capitalist society in the North, that it could not continue. So, of course, we know what happened, and, you know, this is not about trying to fight Gettysburg all over again. So, you know, I don't want to belabor that, but I mean, in Reconstruction, those who were honest made no bones about the fact that that they were not just building buildings in the South. They were reconstructing the culture of the South and removing remnants of the old order. I mean, that seemed like what, you know, some of them were saying. And so if we move on then to the 1930s, and you can interrupt, you know, you can, sure, interrupt and say anything here that you wanted, certainly. But we come to the group known as the Agrarians, the Southern Agrarians. And, you know, tell us a little bit about them and how they contrasted with that algorism, that kind of secularized individualism that was presented in the U.S.
So the Agrarians were basically poet philosophers who emerged out of the South in the 1920s, first as a group called the Fugitive Poets. Certainly the best known of them would be people like John Crow Ransom, Robert Penn Warren, Alan Tate, Donald Davidson, Andrew Lytle. I'm missing a couple, but those are, sure, sort of five of the sort of more central figures. Most of whom had very, very strong literary careers as poets, as novelists, as writers. Alan Tate was the poet laureate of the United States at one point. So these are very, very educated Southern gentlemen, very literate, who were also, though, I think, incredibly proud of their roots and incredibly proud of the kind of society that they were nurtured in and that they grew in, and the way of life that they idealized, right, was certainly not the antebellum South. I'm sorry, certainly not the pre-Civil War South, was certainly not slavery, right? Though there,
right,
were certainly racist tendencies in the 1930s,
yes,
among the Southern agrarians, but there were racist tendencies among most Americans in the 1930s.
Yes.
This was not in particular something Southern, right? Growing up in the North, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, like I did, still plenty of racism to be found there as well, right?
Right.
What they idealized, in my mind, was a culture that was first and foremost built in a place, right, in on a piece of land, in a community that people had lived in for a long time, whose ancestors had known each other, had married each other, had lived together, had come to certain common understandings about the way the world worked, about the way the world ought to work, about what was good and what was evil, what was right, what was wrong, and that moral sensibility that they think came out of those strong, fairly organic communities, they saw as being under threat and under siege by industrialization and, in particular, by the kind of economic growth that we were going to see under the New Deal and the preservation and expansion of capitalism throughout the United States. And so they were resisting. They were resisting in the name of, again, some of those more traditional values of family, faith, and certainly of a grounded place in the world. For me, the great appeal of the agrarians was, again, that emphasis on strong communities and, quite frankly, on a certain kind of approach to virtue. You know, Karl Marx, famously wrote in the Communist Manifesto, right, that, all that is solid has melted into air, right, as he's talking about right. the rise of the bourgeoisie and the rise of capitalism. And this notion, right, that everything was going to basically be torn asunder and then rebuilt with a new model in mind that was, again, more efficient, more productive, more economically viable in the way that they think about economically viable, right? Growth was something that the agrarians saw as more or less obliterating a way of life that they thought was more humane and ultimately more human. To go way, way back, right? If you look at the first book the second book of Plato's Republic, you have this wonderful scene where Socrates is asked to talk about, right, the just city. And he lays out a very minimalist vision about what the just city looks like. It's a place where people basically farm, they give praise to the gods, they live together within their means, they socialize with one another in temperate ways, and by and large, they exist in what we would think of as a kind of ideal agrarian community, right? Self-sufficient, and yet, of course, communal. And the students that Socrates is talking to in the Republic all say, well, that's a city for pigs, right? That who would want to live like that?
Right.
And instead, they encourage him then to talk about what it would mean to live in a city that had art and literature and architecture and what we would think of as economic growth. And he says, oh, you want me to talk about what justice looks like in the feverish city, which is what he calls it in the Republic. Yes. And so then, of course, he has to build out, right, this whole class of people that he calls the guardians, who basically are charged with regulating the affairs of everybody else in order to maintain the virtue necessary to sustain the society over time. And so we go from a very decentralized vision of what a just political society looks like to a very hierarchical, very centralized system of what it looks like, where everybody has a place and a role within that they are not allowed ultimately to escape from based on the quality of their soul. And it's such a fascinating parallel for me to think about the agrarians as a sort of lens to view their work through, as thinking about at least my reading of them, which is a little idealized probably, but as people who were attempting to preserve what they saw as the conditions necessary for a virtuous human life, and worried that the conditions that were being created at the national level and the international level were going to remove that basis without actually finding anything to substitute for it that was going to be nourishing to the human soul and spirit.
And that is an excellent way to describe the vision as I've read them over the years. And that takes me then to your most recent book, which we don't have a lot of time, sadly, to talk about. But, you know, it's called Radical Conversion. And you write explicitly as a Roman Catholic citizen living in the United States, which I appreciate, even though that is not my theological position. But I would much rather someone do, like, I know you have one Alfred Smith story in this book about when he heard about encyclicals. He said, what is an encyclical? And again, for everybody, Al Smith ran for president in 1928 against Herbert Hoover. He's a Democrat candidate. But another Smith story, and I've not checked to verify it, largely because I don't want to be proven wrong, because I think it's a great story and I don't want to know if it, I don't want to know if it's wrong or not. So I just
tell
it as
possible. My family would say it's either a great story or it's true.
There you go. But when he was asked, "Will you govern as a Roman Catholic?" he took out his rosary beads and said, "What does this tell you?" So, you know, that's I say that in appreciation, because,
sure,
you know, those two stories together let you know that, A, he was not going to just take orders secretly from the Pope, as his opponents said. But on the other hand, he did not shy away, versus John F. Kennedy, who gives an entire speech in 1960 in the election promising, "I will not let my religion have anything to do with my governing as president."
Right.
So, but in your book, you talk about the need for Christians in general and Roman Catholics in particular to not adopt the modern liberal perspective of checking your religion. So I'm going to read one quote from your book. You say, "The questions I want to raise in the next section have to do with whether this check your religion at the door approach to American citizenship is theologically sound, legally / constitutionally required, politically desirable, and actually feasible. By way of prelude, my answers will be no, 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 and no."
That sounds like me.
Well, but you tell us about this, though, if you can unpack that just a little bit. Well, you know, as to the question, why should we as Americans? So if I don't approach you as a liberal, but if I did approach you as a liberal and say, sure, why should we not make Christians shut their mouths? Because the only way we can have peace is to have a neutral public square. How do you, as a faithful Christian Roman Catholic, how do you answer him?
So, I mean, it is a lot to unpack, but the short version works something like this, that peace itself, right, is a theological virtue. And the idea that peace is, as Aquinas would say, the natural order, is actually, of course, grounded, right, in his belief and understanding of God and what it is God asks for us. You know, in an exchange in a very conservative monthly called First Things, Richard John Neuhaus was having an argument once with the liberal Stanley Fish about the role of religion in the public square. And one of the lines that Neuhaus uses is that the reason we don't kill each other over God is because God wills that we do not kill each other over God, right? It is literally the call to be peacemakers and the call ultimately to love each and every other person and see in them the face of Christ that is, for me, the only salvation, if you will, for a people. Right? Auden, in his famous poem, said it best, right? He said, "We must love one another or die." And I think he's right about that. And I think that Christians understand that when they are being good Christians, right? That we must love one another or perish. And to that extent, then, there are two things for me. One, we are required by the faith to speak up and to bear witness. And to do that is an obligation and a duty and a responsibility of the faithful, regardless of whatever Caesar might command or might proclaim. Secondarily, it is good for people that there are folks in the world who are willing to work as hard as they can to love them unequivocally. I realize that, of course, that there are occasionally those people who come along or those angels who come along who do not want to be loved, but they don't get to choose for me.
Right.
I have to decide that I'm going to love each and every one of those people, whether they want me to or not.
Mm.
Now I get on my high horse about
this. I'm glad.
To the extent that somebody wants to proclaim that people who want to bring love, and I'm not talking about squishy romantic love.
Certainly, right.
Agapic love here, which is sometimes hard and sometimes difficult, and certainly I am an imperfect vessel of this most of the time, but I know at least what my goal is. And
yes.
I know that I live in a world that without that, we are much more likely to slaughter one another and to lay waste to this gift that we have been given of life on this earth.
And as Christians, I mean, our faith, you know, you refer to Karl Barth in one place, again, early in the book, when he says that such a faith, by definition, cannot be private without committing serious theological error.
Absolutely.
We are people of the incarnation. You know, we're in the midst of Advent right now, and as we anticipate, you know, the time of Nativity, and we look for the second coming of Christ. And in this time, though, we cannot be quiet to, you know, private vessels, but because Jesus himself was neither quiet nor private. I mean, he was not a rabble-rouser, certainly, but he's God in the flesh, and he lived in the flesh, and he did things. So, and his love of people, it was demonstrated in ways that blessed many and also irritated many. And so you could argue that Jesus was not liberal in the, you know, it's certainly not in the modern sense, because he was very open about his mission.
There's absolutely no sense in which you can look at the incarnation and not see a call to publicness and a call to communal publicness on behalf of the faith. Not in my humble, and I'm not a theologian by training, so I am a neophyte when it comes to this. I am a person of faith who has done as much reading as he can, but I am not a trained theologian. But the incarnation itself tells us, if it tells us nothing else, that this world matters. It is not the end all and be all. It is not the final place for the Christian to rest. It is a place in which we are, as Augustine would say, pilgrims.
Yes.
But while we are pilgrims and we are on our journey, this place matters. This life matters. And to the extent that it is a gift from God, we are obligated to spend that gift and to, as we're called upon in the scriptures, to die to the self.
Yes. Well, I would just ask one more question.
Of course.
And I would love, because I'm having a lot of fun here, and I would love to dive further in, because you pack a lot into these books, and I want to ask you about Jacques Maritain and personalism.
Sure.
So you know, you talk about personalism as an antidote to, or maybe not, I don't know if you'd say antidote, but as the righteous alternative to modern individualism. So my question is, I guess I'm going to cheat and combine two questions in one, is how would you describe personalism, and then how are we, as God's people, you know, how can we demonstrate personalism towards one another as our calling in society?
So I start in my own thinking, right, with my favorite passage from Scripture. And we talked about this the other day, but for the audience, the passage in Matthew where he asks the question, right? Not two sparrows sold in the marketplace for a penny, and yet not one of them falls to the earth without your Father noticing, right? Every hair on your head has been counted. And that image of a deeply invested and personal God who knows and calls me by name is, for me, the grounding of personalism. When I think about what personalism is, and I try and explain this to my students from my perspective, so my be the best way for me to do this is I say to them that right now there are roughly 7.5 billion people living on this planet. And prior to that, there were billions who preceded us, and God willing, there will be billions who follow us. And here's the thing, not any one of those billions and billions of people is you. That you are unique and you are special and you are a person. And when we talk about somebody as a person, we're talking not about an abstraction, a rights-bearing creature, which is not an unimportant thing to be, but we are talking about something that is sacred and something that is unique in the world. And that uniqueness calls for a response from all of God's creatures, all human beings, to see that person as sacred and inviolable and deserving of dignity and respect and love. And so the passage that Maritain quotes from Thomas Aquinas is among the most powerful images in my mind, where he says that according to Aquinas, the good of one human being is greater than all of created nature put together. And the reason that he says that is because only human beings have a supernatural end as opposed to simply a natural end or existence. And to that extent, then, because we are creatures with souls, we are created in the image and likeness of God, we are ultimately blessed and sacred and important beyond measure. Now, how do you translate that into a politics? The first thing you do is you start from the premise that I am called and obligated, as hard as it can be sometimes, to love each and every person I encounter the way that God wants me to love each and every person I encounter. And sometimes, like with my grandson, that's going to look a little mean when he's not doing what he's supposed to. And sometimes it's going to look really sweet and nice when he is doing what he's supposed to. Because loving him doesn't mean letting him do anything he wants. Loving him means helping him become the kind of person that he needs and ought to be. And by doing that, he helps me become the kind of person that I ought to be.
That's it's a mutual.
Absolutely. Sorry. No, he teaches me every day about patience, kindness, generosity, and love, sometimes through how he behaves and sometimes how I respond to how he behaves. My wife would say the same thing about me.
But that's good news, though.
Because every person that
God puts across your path, there is a purpose for that person being there. And it's not just for you to love that person in some way, but also you receive a degree of love as well. If nothing else, God is teaching you through that person.
I agree completely, and I say this all the time, and you would know this as well. Sometimes God sends me what I want, and sometimes God sends me what I need. And the truth of the matter is, I'm a really bad judge a lot of the time about what I want.
I need to
be given what I need a whole lot more than I need to be given what I want.
Yes, that's a lesson for all of us to hear. Dr. Duncan, we really appreciate this. This has been great. It's been very enlightening and inspiring. And I don't always say that it's inspiring to talk to someone who's, you know, very much in the regular academic mold, but your work surpasses mere academics. There's a degree of edification and exhortation, especially in your last book, that I really admire. And so I appreciate your work, and I appreciate you taking time to talk today.
Well, Matt, I can't thank you enough. You know, to have somebody read you is a grace, but to have somebody read you thoughtfully and carefully is an extra grace. And so I appreciate you taking me seriously, and whatever disagreements we may have, maybe we can have a conversation about those sometimes, but I feel a lot of sympathy from where I hear you coming from. So I really do appreciate you taking the time, like I said, to pick up those old books of mine and take them seriously. So thank you.
Yes. So again, his books, the Anti-Federalist and Early American Political Thought, and then his most recent book, Radical Conversion, Theorizing Catholic Citizenship in the American Liberal State, is not just for Roman Catholics. I mean, that's intended. That's who it is intended for. But there's much that we can learn as Christians in the United States. So if you get a chance, get that. Thank you, Dr. Duncan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care of yourself. All right. God bless.
Thank you.